Have you noticed anything creepy about the twins, apart from the fact that they're twins?
Just because they're twins doesn't automatically make them creepy.
It does a little bit. Yeah.
When I was your age, television was called books. You'll have to take me the way that you find me. What's gone is gone, the night to knock either down.
I don't remember, sings Peter Gabriel, the opening music there. And if we ever find ourselves in the kind of world that's posited in the dazzling, shimmering novel that we're going to be discussing in this episode of the Book Exchange Podcast, you won't have to. So I'd like to welcome everybody to episode 51 of the Book Exchange Podcast. We are back. The BXC twins have returned after a brief hiatus, and I'm glad to report that we're ready to go on a new episode of this exchange. I'm going to welcome in my twin brother and roommate, former college student, my twin brother, John F. Lovell from Easton, Maryland. John, are you there?
I am here, and we are back, so it's good to be back. So, looking forward to this discussion. How's it going tonight?
It's going all right. I'm dealing with some minor squabbles or little headaches on the side as we go into the podcast here, but we're going to set those things aside. By the way, I said former college student. I meant like my fellow college student because we went to college together, so I'll correct that. But the point is we are back after taking hiatus. There were just some personal things that had to be attended to. On both sides, maybe a little more on John's side, but we're back now, and we have a really interesting and fascinating episode lined up for tonight. We're going to be doing returning to a episode, the type of episode that we've done a few times. I used to know this number, but it escapes me now, but I think it's the sixth or maybe the fifth of our BXC reviews episode. So that's to just remind our listeners, that's an episode where we take one book and do kind of a deep dive into that book. Although in this case, John, it's almost two books. And I'll explain that. Yeah, I'll explain that right now. So we're going to be talking tonight and diving deeply into the dazzling new novel from one of America's most prominent literary fiction voices. We're going to talk about a book called The Candy House, which was written by Jennifer Egan. And if for those of you who have been paying attention and listening to us for some time, you can go all the way back to episode 5, where we talked about some of our most favorite female writers, not all of them, but some of them. Jennifer Egan was prominently a member of the list that I created for that episode. I'm a very big fan of Jennifer Egan. And so we're going to talk about her brand new novel tonight, which is called The Candy House, and do a deep dive into it. And when I said that, you know, it's almost two books, that's because The Candy House, and we'll get into this a lot, I would imagine, has been described as a sequel to her novel, previous novel from 2010 called A Visit from the Goon Squad. It's been described as a sibling novel. It's been described as kind of a sort of a novel with a dotted line to A Visit from the Goon Squad. I'm not sure exactly what the relationship is there, and I'm not even sure that Jennifer Egan is. So we'll talk about that as well. So that is the subject of our episode tonight. Is there anything that you want to say kind of out of the gate about The Candy House or Jennifer Egan, John, or do you want to just get into the affairs of our normal routine?
Well, I would just like to congratulate you because I know you've been holding out for this episode for a long, long time, and you made it. You finally got to it. Congratulations there, but with good reason, because Jennifer Egan is easily one of the most interesting writers, I think, working today. I think we would both agree on that. Just a fascinating, just a hungry intellect, I guess I would call her. Really kind of an innovator in the way that she writes her fiction. And it's going to be a really interesting episode. And the way these two books are related is really, I mean, there's no way we'll be able to you know, explain or expound on that completely. There's so much going on in both of these books. You know, it would take multiple episodes just to unpack it all, but we'll do our best. But I know you've been excited to have this conversation for a long time. I'm excited to have it too. This one should be a lot of fun. So, you know, with that, I think we can go right into our normal run of show here, the way we do things here at the Book Exchange Podcast.
Right. Yeah. I am very excited. I think we'll start off in a little bit doing some just more sort of broader talk really quickly about Egan and sort of how we got to her and sort of our general impressions of her. So we'll save that for a few minutes. But for right now, I just want to remind listeners, you can get our contact information on all of the podcast descriptions, wherever you get your podcasts. There's an email address. And there's also a way that you can leave us a voicemail if you want to. So check those things out if you'd like to get in touch with us, suggest anything for the show. But for now, I'll wait to take a break. But why don't we get into talking about what it is that we are reading right now, which is the normal format on our show. So, John, I'll kick the ball over to you. Tell us what you're reading.
Well, that's interesting, dude, that you should ask that question, even though that is the format of our show. But I'm reading, I just started reading a collection of short stories that you may have some familiarity with. That's right, folks. My brother here is a fiction writer and has been for decades, really, a long time. And he just finished, I'm happy to report, just finished a brand new volume of short stories, which is not even out yet, but it's forthcoming, I think, in the next couple months. It's a book called All Men Are Brothers. It's a collection of, what is it, 8 or 9 short stories? I should have done my homework, but I didn't. How many stories in the collection? It's 8. Okay. And they're all new story. Well, there is one story that's a revision of something that I happen to know that you wrote actually many, many years ago, but you revisited some older material. But yeah, this is an exciting event for both of us, really. The fact that you have it's your first, I would say, you know, I was thinking about this. So you, a couple of years back, I think it's about 2 years back, you released kind of sort of a collected, you know, volume of stories, and then you added about 5 or 6 new ones. That was called Door in the Air. It's an excellent book. I highly recommend it. You can get it on Amazon. The title story in particular, I've said this on the show before, is a stunner. But as far as like your first, you know, the last time you put out a collection of all new stories, that goes back quite a ways. Am I right?
Yeah, you are. Technically, that goes all the way back to the first collection that I put out. Yeah.
Oh, I was okay. So you have that collection that we just talked about, Door in the Air. There's your first collection of stories was called We'll See You When We Get There. And then there was one called Crowning.
Right.
So, but Crowning, did Crowning have some older material in it?
Crowning had a cut. Yeah, it was a smaller volume. I mean, not okay. To get too derailed, but it had a few older stories in there and then a couple new ones. And in a way, it was a bit of a kind of, you know, compendium or whatever you want to call it. But the first one I did that was really all original stuff, quote unquote, was We'll See You When We Get There. So that goes all the way back to 2013.
Well, I'm really excited to read your new one. I just want to shout out to, you know, call out to our listeners. You know, I'm only on the first story, which is the title story called All Men Are Brothers. And all I can say about it is that it's set during World War II. But the diversity of subject matter in this thing just sounds really good. You know, I've read a couple of these stories ahead of time. I happen to know what some of them are about. But, I mean, there's a World War II story. There's a story about the legendary punk rock or rock artist Lemmy from Motorhead. There's a story, it's been mentioned on the podcast before when you were working on it, but there's a story about Ron McNair, who died tragically on the Space Shuttle Challenger in that explosion in 1986. There's just all kinds of really interesting sounding stories in this volume. I'm very excited to be diving into it. I don't have too much to say because I just started, but I really hope that our listeners will keep an eye out for it when it is out in the next couple months. Again, you can look for all of Jude's books, which are many, on Amazon. And without having read this volume yet, I'm a big fan of your short stories. And I'm really excited to dive into this one. I hope a lot of people out there will check it out.
Well, thank you for that, John. I appreciate that. Of course, I knew you were reading it, but I appreciate that you were willing to read it. Of course, John is my primary sort of beta reader, although it's been harder for him in the last 4 or 5 years to do that, just for various reasons. He's got, you know, 4 active growing children and lots of responsibility. So, but I appreciate that you worked this in, John. And I'm very excited about that book. I won't really continue to talk about it, but I'm really pleased with it, and I hope that you like it and that I can get it out there and that some other readers like it. So thanks a lot for mentioning that, even though I made you.
Hey, that's what I'm reading. So what do you have for us?
Well, I'm reading, and I'll make it quick because it's not, it's not right down the middle of the plate, so to speak, in terms of your interests, John, but I happen to be reading, I'm reading a nonfiction book. It's a baseball book. I've been doing a lot of reading about baseball and watching baseball because I happen to be, my current writing project is I'm writing a nonfiction book that has to do with baseball. It's a series of reflections about some of my memories of baseball as a youth and then some of the experiences I've had sort of because getting re-engaged with the game of baseball over the last 2 years since the middle of the pandemic. And how baseball kind of stepped in and was a way for me to manage some of the things I was going through during the pandemic. So I'm working on that. So the book that I happen to be reading to sort of support or research a little bit, it's a really fascinating book for baseball nuts, which you are not, but it's called K, and it's written by somebody named Tyler Kepner. And the subtitle is A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. And what it is that it's K, of course, is the baseball shorthand for strikeout. And yep. It's kind of exactly what it says. It takes, my brother-in-law is a big baseball fan. Shout out to Jeff, our brother-in-law. And he's a guy who recommended it to me. When he recommended it to me, I thought, well, that's crazy. A history of baseball in 10 pitches. And I thought it was literally 10 pitches, like the knuckleball that Goose Gossage threw in the 1972 World Series to the second batter in the second inning or something like that, you know? And I thought, How are you going to do that? That's not what it is. And I should have figured this out, but it examines different kinds of pitches. So the knuckleball, screwball, the splitter, the fastball, et cetera. And It goes through a history of the game by examining each of these pitches. And, you know, being a resurgent baseball fan, I am actually very interested and getting very nerdy about the mechanics of the game. And I don't know a damn thing, pardon my French, about the differences between pitches and how pitchers throw them and what they have to do and the mechanics involved. And I am really fascinated by this book. It's really crazy how complicated pitching at the major league level is. And when you think about it, in the game of baseball, everything, it's one of the only sports where play – action begins by a member of the defense doing something, and nothing happens in the game at all without the pitcher making a number of decisions first from that little hill in the middle of the field and then choosing a pitch and throwing it. And that's where all the action from baseball proceeds. And so when you look at it that way and you start to get into the history of the pitches and how the pitches function, even from like a physics standpoint, it is nuts. So I'll leave it there. Cause not everybody's into baseball, but I'm finding it very fascinating and how that translates into what I'm going to write. I have no idea. I really have no baseball cred at all. It's just a subject that I'm really gripped by, but I'm just happy to be reading about it, frankly. So that's what I'm reading. So you have any comment on that, or do you want to, just proceed?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I nodded off for a second there.
I thought we were breaking down. Oh, that's a good one.
No, I'm just kidding around. I was listening. That actually does sound like a really interesting book, and I'm not just saying that for your benefit. I'm not nearly the baseball fan that you are, but that does sound like a really interesting approach to, obviously, the game has a long history. And I think your idea for what you're writing about, I know it's still, you know, in gestation, but that sounds pretty cool to me, you know, kind of connecting, like, you know, cause I was there for a lot of the early memories that I presume are going to come up in the book with Dad, and, you know, the way he used to watch games. Sometimes we would score them, et cetera. And then, you know, jumping forward to this, to the pandemic, and kind of getting re-engaged with that. I think that's kind of a cool idea. So, yeah, that actually does sound like an interesting book. And it's like, if you kind of get into something, sometimes you just dive down the rabbit hole and it can get really like fine and nerdy, but it's a lot of fun, you know, rediscovering something like that and then kind of really getting into it. You know, and I can just hear when you tell me about what you've been watching or what you've been reading that's been a lot of fun for you. So that's cool. I think I genuinely think that sounds like a cool project to be working on. So that's great.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I mean, I feel like I need to spend a lot of time working on this book, figuring out what I want it to be, but I would liken it to, you know, and I promise I'll stop talking about my own writing, but you remember I wrote, it's now 7 years ago, I wrote a book about my favorite rock band, which is Rush from Canada.
I do remember.
Yeah, that book is actually my most successful book. That book has sold the most, you know, around the world, which is interesting. And believe me, I'm not talking about a lot of sales here, but I remember when I was writing that book, and here's the connection. I felt, I was like, man, I have no business writing about a rock band. I have no connection to the music industry. I'm not a musician. I'm not a music journalist. Nothing. I just really want to write about this group that I love so much. And I kind of went down the rabbit hole. And this is very similar. This is like, and you're right, you can just kind of fall into it. And for me, when that happens from like a writing point of view, I feel like I'm on the right track. There's no warrant for me to write a book about baseball. I mean, there's a gazillion great books about baseball. I don't care. It's just kind of got my mind right now. And that's kind of the attitude I'm taking. So, you know, but anyway, the book K is really, it's really fascinating. It's a great recommendation.
Yeah. That's good stuff. We could go on and on and on, but we got a lot to talk about with Jennifer Egan here. So
we sure do. So we're going to take a quick break now. Let's do a little music from Void's Panda, my son, nice. Patrick.
Yeah.
And then we'll return to begin our discussion of The Candy House by Jennifer Egan. Don't go away. John, we are back, and now we do need to dive right into our discussion of Jennifer Egan's work, and particularly The Candy House, and maybe the sibling novel called A Visit from the Goon Squad. So I'm just going to set this up in a really basic way. I'll go first, just sort of by necessity. I'm going to just do a little rundown of how I came to Jennifer Egan's work, and then I'll ask you to do the same. And then when you hand the ball back to me, I just have one kind of really quick set of question that you're really going to hate because it's difficult, but we'll kind of get into it from there. I would just say to our listeners, we have even less of a roadmap on this one than we do on our other deep dives into books or some of our other episodes. And that's because this material is really hard to encompass in one discussion, as we're going to get into. And if anybody checks out or is familiar with Jennifer Egan's work, or checks these books out as a consequence of listening to this podcast, you'll see that as well. I mean, there is a lot going on in her books, but just really quickly, yeah, I got to say, I you know, and you hit on it before, John, I'm really excited to talk about Jennifer Egan's work. I joke with my kids know that I'm a fan of this writer named Jennifer Egan, who's sort of generous enough and kind enough to sort of engage with you on Twitter occasionally. Like if you tag her Twitter handle and say you're reading her book or something, she'll say something nice back. And my older kids have joked with me about that. But I got to say, I normally hate this term, but if there's any writer in the world that I kind of fangirl over, and I do mean fangirl, like a squealing little fangirl, Jennifer Egan is one of those writers. There's not very many of them. And we could talk about why, but I really, in all seriousness, I consider her kind of one of my literary heroes, really. And it's just because she writes a particular type of fiction that's, and here's where I'm going to get into trouble trying to categorize this, but her books are all very, I would call them filled with kind of a creative and kinetic energy. She has a very hungry intellect. She writes a different book kind of every time, but she often writes about technology and sort of broader type of topics like the passage of time and how technology and time and psychology in human relationships. And she finds really fascinating ways to write about these themes through a series of really amazing novels that she's written. They're often episodic, follow different characters around doing very different things. And these characters and their stories kind of interlock and intertwine in some fascinating ways in her books. I first came to her, it was just kind of by accident. The first book by her I read was a book that came out, I think it was 2006, and it's called The Keep. And it's come up once or twice here. I don't even know how to describe it. It's a novel set primarily in like a Gothic medieval castle in Germany, where there is kind of a mystery going on with the inhabitants there, but turns out to be kind of a Russian doll of a book with several stories kind of unfolding within the story. And there's a lot of kind of metaphysical twists and turns that happen in that book, and metaphorical twists and turns with the actual keep, where these medieval castles were built with like a room that was like kind of the place where you hang out when you're getting invaded, called the keep, you know, and there's a lot of like really complicated and intertwining plot lines in that story. And I happened to see, I just looked at the Amazon page for that book once. I was very fascinated by it. I don't even know how I got there. And then on that page, there was an interview with her. And I was reading through the interview, and I was kind of, when I read that interview with her, I related so much to what she was explaining in terms of her writing process and her creative process and what she was trying to do in her books. And I remember thinking, sight unseen, I got to read this book and I got to latch on to this writer. And it was just by the way she was talking in interviews. And I think you can also vouch, John, I would just say as a side note, Jennifer Egan is also a very interesting interview or listen on a podcast or in a print interview. If you get the chance and you're interested in her work to listen to her talk about what she's trying to do or read an interview with her, you should kind of jump on that. Anyway, I read The Keep and then I was kind of hooked in from that. And then A Visit from the Goon Squad came out in 2010, and we'll get into it a little bit. But it kind of, at first was not very commercially successful because it's such a complicated story, but it kind of latched on. So anyway, A Visit from the Goon Squad came out in 2010. As I was saying there, it got a good critical reception. It didn't really take off with audiences right away, but then it started to build up and catch on to the zeitgeist. It was like a very buzzy book, and it cruised all the way to winning, I think, a couple major awards, and culminating with the Pulitzer Prize in 2011, which sort of, you know, put Jennifer Egan on the map. And she already had been in certain ways.
And the National Book Critics Circle Award as well.
Right, right. And I remember when that book came out, you know, I think both of us were fans of hers by then. But reading that, it did kind of feel like a game changer. But and then I was kind of attached to her kind of from there. And then she's also put out a couple of other books that preceded that. A really huge one for me was a novel she put out in 2001 called Look at Me, which was, again, a bunch of intertwining stories. One of them had to do with the fashion model. And another one, we're talking about somebody who has a finger on kind of what's going on in the United States enough that her novel, Look at Me, this is a good example of the kind of writer Jennifer Egan is, came out within 2 weeks of 9/11. Like, it was published right at the same time as 9/11, which was disastrous for, you know, her sales and, like, her, you know, the publishing industry in general. But the novel that came out had a Middle Eastern terrorist performing an act of terrorism in the United States in the novel, which was, of course, before 9/11, completely unheard of and wildly implausible until it actually happened. So Jennifer Egan is the type of writer who can kind of read the tea leaves and come up with something plausible that can still be kind of world-changing. And we'll get into some more of that. So anyway, that's how I got to her work. And how did you come around to reading Jennifer Egan's work, John?
Well, just a slight mild correction. Like, there was a previous bomb that was planted in the World Trade Center by somebody from the Middle East, I believe. So it wasn't totally unheard of.
You're right.
In the early 90s. But still, yeah, there was a lot of prescience in that novel, which I've also read, Look at Me. And, you know, we can maybe touch on that in a second. But I'm like you. And you know, it's no accident why. I think you read The Keep. I know you read The Keep first. That was the first thing, as you just explained, you read from Jennifer Egan. And it was just before A Visit from the Goon. I think it was before, but A Visit from the Goon Squad came out. And then you read that and were very excited about that. But I read The Keep as well, basically through your recommendation. And The Keep is a very strange mix of different storylines, which is something that, you know, is a through line for Jennifer Egan's books, at least for me. She often has a lot of balls up in the air, and they're strange. They're often a strange kind of mix of elements. There's usually something that has to do with technology. There's usually at least one storyline that has to do with sort of I would say like either some kind of psychological problem or someone who's maybe dealing with mental issues that comes up again and again in her books. Mm-hmm. And it's no accident that it does, because she's been very candid about the fact that she had a brother who is schizophrenic who tragically took his own life. And she's talked about that in interviews that she's done. And that comes up with, you know, people with psychological problems come up again and again in her books, right up to and including The Candy House. So that's interesting. And we'll get into this more, but I remember reading The Keep and thinking it was a really interesting kind of combination of stories and plot elements, but it didn't cohere for me. You know, I thought it was really interesting, but like kind of on a human level, it didn't sort of all come together for me, which is an experience I've had with other Jennifer Egan books, like Look at Me as another example. She definitely, you know, there's definitely, I really admire how she, again, tends to throw up many, many balls in the air and kind of see and juggles them in interesting ways. And so she's a really sort of intriguing writer who tries things. I mean, I'm hard pressed to think of another writer who writes the same way she does. And we'll get into this more, but you know, I was fascinated with The Keep, while at the same time, there are elements of it that weren't totally satisfying for me, but there's something about, you know, how just sort of curious she is that is appealing to me. So that was how I first came to her. And then I read A Visit from the Goon Squad. And, you know, it sort of goes from there. But we're going to, like you said, we're going to talk about A Visit from the Goon Squad and The Candy House Lot. So that was my first sort of introduction to her, was The Keep.
Yeah. And she had, and I remember talking to you both with The Keep and with Look at Me, which you read at different times. But, you know, we were you know, we always found her work to be discussion worthy once we both started reading. And I remember you neither one of those books, you know, really worked for you. And I remember talking with you about it because I was very much of two minds. I liked them both better than you liked them, but I also could see, and I think this applies to most of her books, really, you could see how certain types of readers would struggle to, grasp the connections that she's drawing between these sort of divergent themes and storylines in many of her books. None of them, like, including The Candy House and Visit from the Goon Squad, in a way, like, really fully connect tightly. You know, like, they have this kind of episodic feel, but it's sometimes hard to figure out, you know, how they all fit together or how everything works. But I remember for me, and this has been my experience with all the four books that we've mentioned so far, Look at Me, The Keep, A Visit from the Goon Squad, and The Candy House, I felt such a powerful sort of creative energy and hunger for, like, information, but not just information, kind of like almost like philosophical type of longing beneath all these stories, of asking kind of meta type of questions, the same type of questions that the reader is asking in a way, like, how does this all fit together? What does all this stuff mean? And you could kind of feel this buzzy sense, in my opinion, under her works that really enthralls me. And that for me is like almost supersedes, it allows me to forgive any parts of the books that don't kind of come together all the way, but that would not be the case with all readers. And that doesn't always pass your test, John. So it's interesting, very interesting, about how people to, you know, speculate on how people might react to her work and, you know, what's really going on in her books. But anyway, I just want to mention she has three other books that are worth reading, but not quite in the same family as the books we've mentioned so far. Her debut novel is called The Invisible Circus. It came out, I think, in the 90s, and it's very different from her other novels. There was a lot of, in my opinion, growth and kind of development of her as a fiction writer. The Invisible Circus is kind of a coming-of-age story about a young woman traveling around in Europe, which is something that Jennifer Egan did when she was a young woman. And there's a little bit of a mystery of her trying to find somebody, but it's much more conventional of a fiction than most of her other books. She also has one collection of short stories, which is a very interesting book, but kind of hit and miss. It's called Emerald City. And then she did put out another very good book, in my opinion, called Manhattan Beach. That's the book that kind of split A Visit from the Goon Squad in 2011 and The Candy House this year. Manhattan Beach came out in 2018 or 2019. It was very successful, but it was more of a historical novel set in New York in the World War II years. Also a very good book, but not as like edgy and kind of buzzy as the other books that we've been talking about. So
have you read all of her books?
Have I read all of her books?
Yeah.
I believe I have. Yes.
You read Emerald City and you read The Invisible Circus?
Yes. I'm not as big a fan of The Invisible Circus, but it's just interesting. In my opinion, she really made a huge with her first novel, is The Invisible Circus, and the second one is Look at Me. And then I think the stories came out in between, and there's a huge leap, in my opinion, between The Invisible Circus and Look at Me. Like, they're very different kinds of books.
You know, it's interesting because I actually own The Invisible Circus, but I haven't read it. But just to hear your description of it, which I think it's sort of semi-autobiographical, as you kind of implied. But and this is just sort of a comment, you know, there are chapters in Goon Squad as well as The Candy House, maybe more Goon Squad, that deal with like young women kind of traveling around Europe. Yes. So, you know, it's kind of interesting that, you know, she seems to have incorporated maybe a little bit of her own personal history that is still kind of showing up in some of her later books.
Yeah, it's very interesting. She says frequently in interviews that she can't stand writing about herself. but she also admits that some elements of her own story find their way in. So, for example, she often has, there's a lot of academics in her work, and that's something that she has said she's personally sort of fascinated with the world of academia and has a lot of personal friends and professors. There is a mention in several books of, in A Visit from the Goon Squad, there's one character who basically travels around in Italy, which is much like Invisible Circus and much like Jennifer Egan's own story. And then that comes up again in The Candy House. And then you mentioned, you sort of noticed kind of astutely that there's a running theme of like psychology and or mental struggles in her books that speaks to her own life. So, you know, she admits in her interviews that there, you know, your life has a way of creeping in when you're a fiction writer. But she also says that she tries not to write about directly autobiographical stuff. So it's just interesting how that works.
Yeah, and there's also, I know when she was a young woman, she was in San Francisco in the Bay Area. And so some of the stuff that's in Goon Squad, which we'll get into this, but Goon Squad, you know, is, it centers very much around the music industry. And there's a bunch of stuff about the punk scene in San Francisco, which, you know, some of that comes from her own experience.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and it's, and I can relate to that a lot. You know, somebody who writes fiction, it's hard to keep your own kind of, I don't know, hangups, you know, I don't know if that's the word, but out of the stories that you write, and she's not immune to that either, but she also has an amazing way of, you know, imagining all kinds of different voices, as we're going to get into when we talk about these two books, which I'll do a little segue right now. I'm going to ask you a horrible question, John. So, so now we're going to turn our attention to The Candy House and its prequel, Visit from the Goon Squad. And I want to ask you, if you had to, this is terrible, but if you had to try in a succinct kind of way to tell a person off the street what the books, these two books, Visit from the Goon Squad and The Candy House, are about, just by way of entry into talking about these two books, how would you even attempt to do that? And I know it's a bad question, but why don't you take a shot at it, and then we'll be off and running.
Yeah. Yeah, I sort of hate you for that question. It's a really tough one. Oh, gosh. I would say, because I have been thinking about both books, I would say, and it's kind of hard not to talk about, now that The Candy House is out, not to talk about them sort of together, because they are so similar, even though they have some different preoccupations. I think readers should know that, that, you know, there's both books involve a whole slew of characters who have different connections between them in both of the novels. But then the characters that are in the novel, A Visit to the Goon Squad, are also connected very much to most of the characters in The Candy House. So there's all kinds of like tendrils back and forth. I think both, this is really tough, man, but I think it's going to sound ridiculous to say this. I think both of the books are interested in the human experience, and kind of, that's really broad, but like kind of what makes us us, you know, like our identity. But they approach them in different ways, or kind of use different structures. The first one, she said this in interviews before, A Visit from the Goon Squad, she was particularly interested in exploring, you know, questions about time. The famous Proust novel, In Search of Lost Time, was a major influence on it. And she decided to use the music. She thought it would be an interesting idea to use the music industry as kind of a way to look at the passage of time and how it affects us as human beings, how human beings experience time and how they look back and, you know, move forward in their lives, et cetera. So that novel seems to focus on questions around, when I say human experience, it's like, you know, how we experience time and memory, but it does so through the lens of the music business, which is a really broad way of describing it. Mm-hmm. But that
that's how I would do it. Whereas the second book has some of the same preoccupations, but the second book is more overtly about technology.
Right.
And the ways in which I would say, you know, modern technologies, especially as, you know, we get to the internet and social media and, you know, she's invented a certain type of technology, which we'll get into, but how modern technology shapes sort of our identity. So I think each of the books kind of goes back to identity and who we are. And the first book, as I said, using kind of the music business as sort of a lens. The second book, using technology and what we might call social media, but it's evolved in this book, which we'll get into, and the ways that that sort of impacts our psyche and the way we think about ourselves and the way we remember and process our lives, etc. So that's kind of a really tough way to describe both of the books, but I think they both ultimately have to do with, you know, human experience and the way our identities and how and what makes us truly human, what makes us authentic. I don't know. I guess I'll stop it there because these are all very interesting questions that we all grapple with, but both of the books kind of deal with them in different ways. And yet there's a lot of like interconnecting threads between the two. And now I'm going to stop because it's just becoming gibberish.
No, actually, I think you did a really good job. And I knew you were up to that, John, you know, because you process books better than sometimes than you realize, just, you know, at least to me, you know, listening to you talk about them. Really hard question, but like, you know, but these books are very hard to classify. And I remember, but I think you generally did it right. They're both about those kind of really broad themes, human experience, how we experience the passage of time, what people are really like versus like, you know, what kind of face they put on for the rest of the world,
right.
How we deal with, you know, stress or affliction, you know, and what things do we turn to when we're under, you know, when we're facing a series of difficult situations, either mentally or physically or what have you, and how we kind of grapple with these things in the modern world, you know, but there, and those are all part and parcel of these books. The big difference, I think you hit on it, was that Goon Squad was, you know, used its kind of template, as its kind of template, the music industry and like these characters she created, you know, weaving in and out of the music industry over several decades. And, but then if you remember at the end of that book, it kind of sort of comes up to, or, and even goes over the edge a little bit. At the end of Goon Squad, the last chapter does have this like prescient technology in it that she imagines. I think the book was published in 2010. And I think the last chapter is like 10 or 20, I think it's 20 years into the future, and it imagines this technology that has to do with babies and the translation of their thoughts, you know, so that you can know more about what babies are trying to say and what their experiences are, if you remember that.
Yeah.
That's in the last chapter of the Goon Squad. And then the Candy House is just, like you said, is more overtly has to do with technology. And she kind of turned her gaze to social media in particular. And the main conceit in Candy House was she wanted to, and I can't say it as well as she does, but she tried to imagine sort of going forward a new form of social media that had to do with the capturing of memories and being able to scan through your memories. And then not only could you capture your memories onto a device, but there is another, and this will get into some of the spoilers, another product of the technology that she describes in the Candy House that allows you to take it one step further and upload your whole conscious memories to something called the Collective, which is this cloud-based storage or resource where you can access the memories of not only yourself, but anybody else who shares their memories onto the collective. So she takes the whole technological angle to these two stories as a kind of, you know, way, a huge step forward in the Candy House. And much of the Candy House deals with the implications of that technology, you know, and how it affects the different people that she creates in this second novel, some of which are either related to the characters from the first novel or are the same characters. So there's also kind of an intergenerational play going on in the second book as well. You know, so it's complicated.
It really is. There's tons of threads in both of these books, and they weave and wind together very intricately within each of the books, but then across the books. So it's like they're really kind of two sides of the same coin in a way.
Yep.
But as we've mentioned, you know, they take sort of different approaches to some of the same general questions that Egan's very interested in. And again, you have characters in both of the books that are dealing with mental illnesses or, you know, the fallout of broken relationships. And, you know, again, it's no accident, I guess, from Jennifer Egan's own personal experience that would be in there. But the second book, as we've said, you know, Candy House is definitely more techie. And I don't know. I mean, I have a pretty big question about the technology in the Candy House that I wanted to ask you about. I mean, is there any reason we can't just dive into that, or did you have more setup that you wanted to go through?
No, I mean, I think we should come up on a technical break here sometime soon. So maybe do you want to do that and then continue, and then we'll start again with your question?
Yeah, that's fine. And then maybe it'll lead us a little bit more into the Candy House specifically.
Yeah, I think from here, this point forward, I do think it'd be best to just kind of, you know, focus on the Candy House. But like you said, you know, there's a little back and forth between that and the Goon Squad that we'll have to do inevitably, but we'll sort of get more into the details of the newer novel as we go forward. So let's take a quick break. We'll come right back and we'll pick it up from there with John's question.
Okay.
Why don't you go ahead? What was the question you wanted to ask me?
Well, actually, before I ask it, I feel like I should say this because we might forget to mention it later. Just there's so much to talk about with this book. But I think it's really important to point out, we haven't pointed it out to this point, that another aspect of both of these books in particular, but Jennifer Egan in general, I would say, is that she has kind of an experimental streak. And she likes to try different things that have basically never been tried before and try to find interesting ways to, you know, to relate certain chapters of both of these books. And she said repeatedly in her interview, she's not trying to do it, you know, just to be innovative or whatever, but she tries to find a story that will correspond to an interesting way to tell it. So for example, you know, very famously, there's a chapter in A Visit from the Goon Squad that's told entirely in PowerPoint.
Right.
And she's talked extensively about how difficult that was to do. And she sort of had the idea. And, you know, there are many false starts to sort of make that work, but it does miraculously sort of work in the book, which is really interesting. And then she does the same thing again in A Visit in the Candy House, where she has, there are two chapters in the book that are really unusual and interesting. And one was told entirely in sort of 140, you know, character bursts, that actually she did tell that story on Twitter before the book came out as sort of an experiment. So there's a chapter that's basically told through, I mean, she doesn't mention Twitter, but it's basically told through the medium of Twitter, which is interesting. And then there's another chapter called See Below, which is told entirely through essentially email or email or some kind of digital correspondence. So
yeah, instant messaging or something like that.
Something like that. So it's pretty interesting. I just wanted to mention that it's only tangentially related to what I was going to talk about, but I think it's important for listeners who maybe haven't read either of these books to know that there's an experimental quality to them, which I found, you know, really fascinating. And especially because she was able to tell stories using these unusual and unorthodox methods, but have them connect to the rest of the narrative. And that's really pretty impressive. So I want to make sure.
Go ahead.
No, you were going to say something.
Well, I'm sorry to cut you off, but there was a really interesting story. So I was doing a little background research after I read The Candy House, and she did.
Who had schizophrenia, like a really severe form of it. Took his own life, as you said, which is very tragic, but. Her story told through tweets
was originally called Black Box. The chapter is called something different in mm-hmm. The Candy House. But it was published like 10 years ago. And so number one, it was done before they lengthened the amount of characters you could use in Twitter. So it was when right. It was 140 and not 240, which is even more impressive. And secondly, she mentioned in an interview that her brother, when he was alive, got the chance to read that story. And he found it worrisome.
And he thought that she was showing signs of psychosis.
Having read the story when he read it, because it was so like, there's a lot of like paranoid qualities in the story. And it's like kind of a story where a lot of danger is, or that's fraught with a lot of danger. And she expressed that she was kind of gratified by the fact that somebody in her family who was going through psychosis thought that the story she wrote was fraught with psychosis. You know, so in a way, she thought that that was a validation of what she was trying to do in the story. So that's very interesting. But that's the kind of thing you get in both of these books. And I also just wanted to say really quickly, you know, the PowerPoint chapter from Visit from the Goon Squad is very famous. Actually, that's one of my least favorite parts of both books. I just recently reread A Visit from the Goon Squad, and I never thought that that chapter really worked. And I still think it's kind of weird and doesn't really come together for me. So that's interesting. A lot of people really thought it was, you know, really stood out. And I think it's kind of weird, but, you know, anyway.
Well, And I think it gives readers, listeners a sense that, you know, both of these books really, like I was saying, they're not afraid to get experimental. She kind of swings for the deep seats a lot in terms of trying different things. You could debate, and people have, and people will endlessly, how much they work. But she's definitely taking huge chances and huge swings in both of these books, which you kind of have to admire, you know, on one level. Right. But so to go back to what my question was going to be in The Candy House, so you mentioned it. I mean, there's a huge element of the plot of The Candy House, which I guess we are spoiling. Anybody who reads this is going to see it in the early going, and it carries throughout the book. There's a character who was a very minor character in A Visit from the Goon Squad who in The Candy House has become like an Elon Musk type figure. You know, right. He's become this like tech superstar recognized all over the planet. And because he's invented a sort of platform, I guess, or technology that's called Own Your Unconscious. And you described it before, you can basically upload your unconscious, your entire unconscious to the cloud. And then, as you said, later on, it becomes a little bit further where there's something called the collective, where everyone can access everyone else's unconscious as long as they've opted in and decided to upload it to the cloud so that anybody can access it. So you probably would predict, just knowing me, I mean, that is like a huge part of this book. But to me, there's just like a fundamental question is, why would anybody do that? You know, like this entire idea, to me, I know you kind of have to go with it and, you know, accept it, that that's a part of the world that we're dealing with in the book, The Candy House. But I personally just could never get it. Why would so many people around the world just decide to give up their entire unconscious and just put it on the cloud for anybody to access? I couldn't get over that. Like, and I wanted to ask you about that, whether you had the same kind of hang up or experience. My head was saying to me, okay, you know, that's part of the world that she's describing, whether you believe it or not. But I just could not, it just seemed like such a fundamental part of the whole book. And yet I just couldn't understand why anyone would want, how that could be a viable business. Why anybody would want to do that, you know? And maybe you could argue people do that in a way through Facebook or whatever, but, and that might be, I don't know. I found that to be, that kind of nagged me throughout the reading of the entire book. And my question for you is, did you have the same hang up or did you just not, and you were able to say, well, that's just part of the world that she envisions? Because that, I got to admit, at the end of the day, that was a little bit of a detriment to me with this book. I just couldn't accept why people around the world would just really do that. Did you have the same experience or not?
Not quite. But I've been really drawn into all of her books, as I've been saying, and all of them for me have this kind of magnetic or hypnotic power. I'm kind of in her hand when she's writing in these books.
Uh-huh.
So it didn't present as much of a problem for me. But so what you're basically saying is, you know, you're not really sure that people would want to do on such a grand scale what this technology in the candy house is offering. You're not really sure you can believe that people would want to do that. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yeah, I couldn't quite buy that. And she even acknowledged this in one of the interviews that I listened to. She said, like, she didn't acknowledge it quite like that, but she said, I don't really know how this would work, but I just decided to go with it anyway. And that's one aspect of it. Like, how would that act? I did ask myself early on, you know, because there are chapters that describe somebody accessing the subconscious of somebody else through this platform. And I was thought to myself, well, how does that actually work? Is it like a movie that's being projected in the backs of your eyelids? You know, so that was one, the sort of the technical aspect of how that works. But then there's the aspect, like I said before, I find it hard to buy that someone would want, like, it's basically saying everything you've ever thought, Jude, or experienced in your life, no matter how embarrassing it is, no matter how whatever, just put it up there on the cloud and, you know, it's probably going to help somebody. And you not having a hang up, having hangups with that. I don't know. I don't know if it should have been a hang up for me, but it was. And it kind of sounds like, you know, it wasn't as much for you and apparently many, many other readers.
Well, I think part of it is, and it's a very good question. I mean, I think like, you know, like part of my experience reading The Candy House was like, I was kind of, cause it, one of the conceits it creates in the story is that there's this whole other subgroup that they call the eluders, which people who sort of promote and support the technology behind Own Your Unconscious. Some of those people are kind of like, almost like, you know, actively seeking out eluders and trying to dissuade them from eluding the technology, you know, like they have like this whole separate wing of people who are trying to snuff out the eluders, which is kind of interesting too. But I think you can make the argument you're making that it's like, you know, not something because, I was starting to say my experience was, while I was reading the book was, I was saying in the back of my mind, well, I would definitely be one of the eluders. I wouldn't be sort of drawn into this technology either. Why would you want to do that? Like you're asking, you know? And I feel like a lot of readers would probably say the same thing to, you know, sort of pat themselves and reassure themselves, you know, while they're reading the book that it wouldn't be them, you know, in this kind of sinister future world. But one of the things that I think Egan is playing with and commenting on is, you know, a lot of those people, I think she's kind of saying that a lot of those people were the same people who probably wouldn't have said that they would buy into like Facebook or Twitter, you know, or Instagram or whatever.
Right. And
one of the things that I think is, in many ways, I think, and I was going to say this to the end, but, you know, we're kind of all over the place because it's impossible not to be all over the place. But I kind of think The Candy House might be kind of a superior novel to A Visit from the Goon Squad. And one of the things, reasons why I think so, is that I think she kind of went further and deeper into some of these questions that she's interested in this second book in a way that was kind of more compelling. And I think the titles of the books, The Candy House is a much better title, a much more interesting title to me than A Visit from the Goon Squad. I never really figured out what she was trying to say with A Visit from the Goon Squad. I got like the Goon Squad is sort of supposed to be time, or it's like it's minions. I never really figured out how that title worked. And in fact, John, I remember when the book was first published in hardcover, A Visit from the Goon Squad, because I was excited that Jennifer Egan was coming out with another book. If you remember, the hardcover was like this hand with an electric guitar, you know, and it was called A Visit from the Goon Squad. And I remember looking at it and being like, what the hell is that supposed to be? You know?
Yeah.
And like, it's almost like the book was impossible to market. And she's commented that when a Goon Squad first came out, it just flopped commercially because nobody knew what it was. You know, and a hand with a guitar on the cover of it doesn't do anything to convey what that book is about. The Candy House is different. Like she says in a few places in the novel, The Candy House, she draws connections between, you know, of course, the famous fairy tale of Hansel and Gretel with the house made out of candy. And it's a metaphor for the technology. So it's in a couple places it says in the book, never trust a candy house. And I think one of the things that Egan is saying is that a lot of people may not believe that they would get sucked into a technology like this, but the allure of it might draw them in and to the point where it's so ubiquitous. And I think she can fall back on actual social media and technologies that everybody has kind of fallen into, you know, Facebook being an example, but you know, John Lovell never fell into Facebook because you don't like Facebook, but most people have, you know, so maybe you wouldn't. You know, and I'm just being facetious. I'm just joking with you a little bit, but I think she's playing with that. And I think she might feel that even though she can't fully bring off exactly technically explaining how this all works, that she obviously decided she could present it in such a way that you could believe as a reader if you were willing to suspend or, you know, make that leap, that so many people would be interested in the technology that they would buy into it. And then I'll let you respond to that in a minute. But another thing I just want to say about this is, it's interesting, just this week, and this, I'm not going to say anything that's new to anybody in the human race, but just this week, my son finished with school, my youngest son, he's 9 years old. He had a great year in third grade and he really liked it. He came back home for the last day of school and he was really sad. And he was crying and he said, "Dad, I just wish I could go back to the beginning of third grade and live it all again." And then I said to him, you know, just an innocent child. And of course, me being John, of course, I quoted, you know, this is our show. So I went back to the Rush catalog and I said, "Well, what you're saying is basically the lyrics that Neil Peart from Rush and Headlong Flight." He says, "Well, I wish that I could live it all again." You know, for all you Rush fans out there. But that concept, John, is what's behind this own your unconscious idea. And, you know, people have an appetite for, which we can't do now, of course, going back and living their experiences again. And this technology gives them a chance to do it with their own memories in a way. And then it gives them a chance to go back and find out whatever happened to Susie that they dated in 10th grade. So I think the leap that Egan is making, just to conclude, is that, you know, there would be enough there to appeal to human nature. And we've seen it happen with other forms of social media. Now, how do you want to respond to that? Like, what would you say? Like, it just wasn't convincing to you?
No, I agree that that's what she's doing. I think that she's done this with, with other things in her books is that she'll, you know, she takes an existing technology and kind of imagines it one or two steps further, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think she is commenting on, in a way, on like how we've all, most of us, as you said, have in a way sort of uploaded our lives into Facebook and share everything on Twitter or Instagram or TikTok or whatever, you know, so that, you know, it's not like, you know, that tendency is in us already. And I think she's sort of extrapolating that out to sort of the next degree with this idea of own your unconscious, you know? So I agree with everything that you just said. I think that she is playing with those ideas, you know, and the book itself, you know, in a few places it says, you know, it mentions how this technology has had all these positive effects, like helping people with dementia kind of remember what their lives were or who was in their lives, et cetera, you know, kind of, and it eliminates XYZ or whatever, you know, it sort of, in a couple places, it talks about what the benefits were and how it's kind of changed humanity, you know, for the better a little bit. I don't know. I mean, it was just, maybe it's like you said, I never went on Facebook, you know, and I'm one of the few people around the world apparently who never did that. So that's could just be a personal thing for me. I can see, you know, wanting to go back and revisit your own memories. I'm not totally sure why you'd want to just put your entire unconscious up online for anybody to browse through. You know, there's some kind of a bargain that's made there that maybe it's just a personal thing. I can't really imagine making, you know, I don't yeah. really want, even if it's my, I would even, you know, question it if it were my own children, you know, who want to, like, and there's a point in the book where the child of the person who invents it goes back and he's like experiencing some of the experiences that the inventor had that were fundamental in his life, like his good friend drowning, for example.
Right.
And his son kind of goes back and he gets to quote unquote experience what his father felt when that happened. And it was just kind of like, I don't know, there's something about that that was a little bit off-putting to me, both in the idea of actually doing that and also, you know, just being able to believe it. But, you know, that said, I mean, that was a hang-up of mine in the book. But I would agree with what you said earlier. Like, I actually think I've been thinking a lot about both books together. And I actually think I had a better time with, and I enjoyed Goon Squad a lot. But I think I found even more interesting The Candy House. Part mm-hmm. of that is because it's so explicitly about technology and the way, and like human authenticity and the way technology, again, it brings us back to our current moment with social media. We have talked about this personally, but many, many others have as well. You're putting up a version of your life on Facebook that is not your real life. I mean, it's only right. the highly real, you know, right. and there are right. very, yeah. And there are very interesting questions about, you know, authenticity and identity. And, you know, is that really you being presented on Snapchat or on Instagram or whatever? Well, not right. really, not really, because like you're only putting up the highlights, you know? So mm-hmm. Egan's playing with all those questions in The Candy House. And I think those are very interesting questions. So, and you know, the music business is interesting. I think the technological bent or aspect of The Candy House made it more interesting to me. Mm-hmm. Somebody maybe who was more of a music fan or connected to the music industry in some way might gravitate more towards Goon Squad. But I think in a weird way, we didn't have totally the same experience with the book, but I think I would say I enjoyed it more than A Visit to the Goon Squad too. And by the way, both of these books, there are a couple of things to say about Egan. Like I find them both, the word I used with you many times is they're both virtuosic. You know, she's writing in a totally different narrative style in almost every chapter in both books. She's covering yes. a lot of ground with technology and human psychology and relationships. And, you know, there's a chapter about going on safari in Africa. And like, so it's just, it's virtuosic. That's the only word that I can think of. And also, I gotta say, when you listen to her interview, you mentioned this before, but she seems so earnest and open and humble in a way. You can't help but love this woman when you hear her interviewed. I think she's just a hungry intellect, and I really think she's doing some very, very interesting things with her fiction that not many writers are doing. You know, so that makes her books, you know, worth diving into in and of themselves, if you ask me. Even though I will say that sometimes they feel like really interesting experiments more than they do like deeply emotional stories, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. I'm really amazed and impressed by her work in general. You know that. And I agree with you about when you listen to her talk about it, she seems like a very real, engaging and compelling person. I mean, I don't know her at all personally, but she just seems like that kind of person. Yeah. You know, and I remember vividly, and I've told you this before, but this is just more for the listeners. Because I think she does, there's a certain thing that she has been able to do in all these books of hers that are more experimental. And I'm talking about these four again, Look at Me, The Keep, and these two books, Goon Squad and The Candy House, where she throws into the air. She's so curious and hungry intellectually, and she's so smart that she has this incredible command over the story she's telling and the way that they all weave together, that I just find, you know, virtuosic or whatever the word is apt, I think. You know, and I remember very vividly reading her novel, Look at Me, and there was a passage right in the middle of the book, and it centered around this terrorist from the Middle East. And he was on an American college campus, and he was kind of posing as an American. I mean, obviously, he was from another country, but he was integrating into the American culture and as a older college student, or maybe a teacher. I can't remember exactly. But he sort of lured in and started dating this, like, 17 or 18-year-old young woman in the story. And there was this one chapter told from his point of view where you're kind of in his mind while he's, like, drawing this young woman in to his world, and she had fallen in love with him because she was innocent and young, and you're in his mind and he's talking about what he intends to do after her, and you know how little you discern from reading the chapter how little regard he has for her personally. He's just kind of using her for XYZ, and he's gonna, you know, essentially drop her off at the next stop or whatever on the way to whatever he was trying to accomplish in the United States. But Egan had created such a convincing portrait of both characters that it read to me like a horror movie. I had young daughters at the time. They were like in grade school. And I thought, this young woman has absolutely no idea what she's gotten involved with. And she's going to get hurt, like really hurt. And I remember reading that chapter, and I was just, it took my breath away. I was like, this is absolutely terrifying, you know? And she can do that, you know, through a variety of characters and a variety of different stories. She writes these very convincing characters that you are fully immersed in their points of view. And she does that in all four books, you know, to me. And I find that just incredible and impressive. And one thing I did want to ask you, did you want to say anything in reaction to that, or can I ask you another question?
No, you can go ahead. Ask another question.
Okay. So you brought up those two chapters in The Candy House. There's one that's told essentially in tweets, even though you're right, it doesn't say anything about Twitter. And it's also like a riveting kind of spy story, you know? And the other one is this chapter, a longer chapter that unfolds via some kind of messaging system, email or whatever, that I don't even know how I could describe it. It has to do with I don't know, like somebody from the music industry in the beginning of it reaches out to somebody else because they hadn't been involved in a documentary project 20 years earlier that's touched on in the Goon Squad novel. And they wanted to find some way to revive their career as a journalist. So they were wondering if they could connect with a musician. And then anyway, I'm screwing it up, but it spins off into this really broad net of characters all trying to connect with one another and trying to bring together a documentary film that will revive the relevancy of this musician, but also this filmmaker, but also this, and it just keeps expanding outward. Yep. All told in the form of emails. John, those two chapters in the Candy House for me, I thought they were, those are the centerpieces of the book in my view. And I thought they both had this incredible hypnotic power. Like, you felt like, for both of them, even though we're told in different media, you felt like something was, they were both something, like I had never read anything like either one of those chapters before, I feel like. And they drew me in so much, and they threw out so many interesting questions. And I just felt kind of hypnotized by them. And when I got to the end of both those chapters, I was like, that is incredible. I've never read anything like that. You know, and I wanted to know if those chapters were striking for you, maybe not. And or did they stand out to you in any way other than just their form?
Yeah, I was going to say they certainly stand out because of the style in which they're written. I don't think they had quite the same impact on me as they did on you. And as a matter of fact, it's pretty interesting because I would even go so far as to say they kind of took me out of the book a little bit.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, in a way they did for me too. You know, They felt different, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, they feel very different, and they're the only two chapters like that, and they don't feel the same as each other. I do feel like the one that's written in basically Twitter form, it, as you say, it tells us sort of like, and it's exciting, tells this kind of exciting sort of spy story. And even though it involves a character who links to other characters in the book, I felt like when I got to the end of it, I felt like, well, that was a really kind of a cool story, but it doesn't, I have no idea why. Like, it doesn't really, other than a personal connection between one of the characters involved and others in the book, it doesn't really connect to the rest of the book. I don't know. I had a little bit of a different experience with those chapters because I thought they were really fun and obviously innovative, but they also kind of took me a little bit out of the main narrative. But they're, you know, for me with the Candy House and Goon Squad in a way, one of the risks of writing books the ways in this way that she does is that, you know, she uses all these different narrative styles, but I guess part of the risk of that is that, you know, it does sort of sometimes feel like you're reading something out of another book. Like another example for me is the very last chapter of the Candy House, which takes sort of the child of one of the minor characters, and it goes back in time to when this child was young. And in a way, like the action of that last chapter is before most of the rest of the book. And yeah, it's a story that has to, strangely enough, it came up earlier, it has to do with baseball.
Right.
And it just has a totally different feel than the rest of the book. And it has a very kind of a sentimental feel, which the rest of the book doesn't have. Mm-hmm. And I thought, when I got to the end of that chapter, I was like, you know, that's a really sort of curious way to end this book, you know, and I'm not quite sure what I think about it. Like I thought it was an odd choice to end the book. So, you know, and while I said before, like I found this book to be a lot of fun, and it's like her books, these books in particular, you know, I have a good friend who read one of these books for the first time, and this friend is really into puzzles. And I think this friend was really intrigued by this book. And I kind of realized, well, in a way, it's because these books are puzzles.
Yeah.
You know, like they have all these kind of like strange pieces and you're trying to fit them together while you're reading it. And then after you're reading it, you're kind of saying, how does this all fit together? So I think one of the things I'm trying to say in a weird way is that with Egan,
I've always felt this with her. I think there's a really, there's this kind of, you know, puzzle's a good word. There's this really sort of intellectual side to her work. It's like these very complicated, these novels are like very complicated machines, and you're trying to figure out how all the pieces work together. You kind of feel like somehow they all work, but you're kind of at the same time trying to figure out why does this all work? And there's almost like a, I don't know, like an engineering or kind of like almost like a mechanical aspect to it that is interesting. But at the same time, you know, whether they, if you're the kind of reader who really connects to like characters in a deep way and or an emotional way, and that's where you draw your satisfaction from, I don't know if Jennifer Egan is exactly your kind of writer. You know, I think mm-hmm. she has emotional moments in her books and stories for sure. I mean, mm-hmm. you just described one of them with like the, your reaction to that chapter and Look at Me and how, you know, you felt that kind of as a father.
Right.
But I would say in general, if you're someone who's looking for kind of a deep emotional experience with the book, you may not get that through her, through these two books. But if you're someone who responds to, as I do, I kind of respond to both sides, but if you're someone who responds to like just, you know, intellectual curiosity and kind of like crafting something that's really complicated with many moving parts and seeing how it all fits together, then these books may appeal to you more, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, you know, it's, she's definitely the kind of writer that, you know, would not appeal to everybody. You know, there would probably just be like a certain amount of the population, the reading population, who would really read these stories and just find them too kind of disjointed or too strange, you know, or even like too kind of like invasive in some way, you know, to really be kind of an entertaining story. And I don't know, for me, like, you know, I say this in every episode, but I look at books like kind of like from a writer's perspective, and I just think they're incredible feats from a fiction writer's perspective. Like, I would never even try to imitate something like this. I mean, I just couldn't do it. I find them just intellectually impressive. Yeah. But there's also, I remember when The Keep came out, I was so sort of, or when I was learning about The Keep and interested in reading The Keep, I found a podcast or something. I was listening to her talk specifically about The Keep. So this is back in like 2006, 2007. So it predates Goon Squad and Manhattan Beach and Kenny House and all that kind of stuff. But I remember her talking. There was two things that she said in like a lengthy podcast that really have stayed with me, you know, over the last 10 or 12 years or wherever it is, 10 or 15 years. One of them was just a simple comment. She said, when I write fiction, I'm really not interested in writing fiction that's either from or about the heart. What I'm interested in writing fiction is in writing fiction that it's from or about the gut. And I thought that was a very interesting comment. She said, I'm not as interested in the heart as I am in the gut. Almost kind of like, you know, so that sort of speaks to, in a way, the comment you just made about how you may not be able to make emotional connections with her stories, yep. You know, because she may not be as interested in human emotion as she is in like instinct or impulse or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that she said, another very simple comment, but that I find interesting in the context of her work. And this is really almost a dealer's choice episode as much as a BXC reviews episode. But anyway, she said once, I think it was the same interview. She said, you know, when I write fiction, I'm trying to write something that is vital. You know, that's the word she used, vital. You know, mm-hmm. And I feel, you know, I would use that word in the context of that chapter I talked about in Look at Me. You know, and many parts of other of her stories, like you feel like there's something kind of real, even though it's not real. You know, it's like kind of the meta thing with fiction, you know, because sort of fictional stories can sometimes be more real than real. But also her books are about, in the main, and I can say this about all of her books, are about things that that have consequence, you know, whether it's, you know, our memories or time passing and wearing effect on us, or, you know, the way we deal with our mental issues, or, you know, and a lot of her stories, none of them do it directly, but they sort of brush against matters of the spirit almost, you know. And she's commented that she, you know, she said this, like many people say in our age, John, it's not necessarily how you and I feel about this, but like, you know, that she does not want to write overtly about spiritual matters, but she doesn't consider herself not to have a belief system, you know, but she has kind of this sort of almost agnostic way of talking about it if it ever comes up. She's not really sure what it is, you know, but she's not discounting, you know, the idea of a spiritual life or spiritual realities. And I also feel that in her books, you know, they're not dismissed. These things are not dismissed in her stories, but they're certainly not explained, and they're not dived into in a great depth the way it would be, you know, perhaps like somebody like Flannery O'Connor or somebody, you know, a spiritual writer in a different sense.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, I think we would both agree that, and maybe this is a way, and we, you know, to kind of wrap this up, because we could talk about it for a long time, but
yeah,
you know, she does what great fiction writers ultimately do, which is kind of plumb the mystery of human existence, really. And I think she's both subconsciously and also consciously trying to do that, you know, in her own way. But anyway, I mean, Egan, certainly just a very formidable writer. One I would highly recommend. I mean, she's definitely, like you said, I mean, there are, whatever you want to say about these two books, I've never read books like them. And, you know, some of the chapters they're in are just incredibly unique. And you just never know what she has coming next. So she's definitely someone, the kind of writer I think we would both agree that, you know, whatever she's pivoting to, we're going to take a look at, because it's she just has such a unique and interesting way of approaching the subjects that she's interested in, that, you know, she's a very compelling writer, I guess is a word that we used earlier. And one that I think we would both highly recommend.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you want to read fiction from a writer who's really probing so many deep and fascinating questions, you know, you really got to read Jennifer Egan. And sort of the last thing I would say about her is that she, also is, and this is in all her books, she's smart enough to be funny. So there's many moments of, you know, humor in her books.
Oh, like, yeah.
In the Candy House, there was one part that took place in this country club with these rich white women who played tennis together. Some of their conversations about, like, you know, the other woman's backhand and stuff like that, they're just hilarious, you know. Like,
go ahead.
No, I was gonna move on to something else, but did you want to say something about that?
No, I was gonna mention another chapter that I thought was really funny, but you might be going to the same place.
No, well, I was just gonna say, segue a little bit, but you can bring it up. I was just gonna say, she also, in particular, these two books, and I thought Candy House in particular, also allowed her to create kind of many very sort of meta moments. And just the, I guess the last thing I would say is, there was one comment early in the Candy House where Bix Bouton, the guy who invents Own Your Unconscious, beginning of the book, is presented as having already invented kind of an ubiquitous social media technology. But when the book opens, he's in transition. He's looking for the next big idea. And that next big idea is Own Your Unconscious. But he hasn't gotten there yet. And so he decides to re-engage with this, like, group, this, like, club around, like, Columbia University or New York University or one of those schools in New York, of, like, professors and think tank kind of people who get together and discuss kind of ideas. And he disguises himself because he's so, you know, ubiquitous. Everybody knows who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes to this group and starts reengaging with them in order to kind of dislodge whatever is going to prompt him in his mind. It's kind of a move of desperation. He wants to hear about ideas and see if he can come up with the next big thing. And at the end of, I think it's the opening chapter, one of the opening chapters. And at the end of the opening chapter, that chapter, you see him kind of in a domestic situation with his wife and a baby son. And he makes this comment, which is, I'm not sure if I can do it all again. And I thought that was a very meta moment, you know, with Jennifer Egan kind of talking through her novel about what she was doing to kind of take another run at the ideas behind A Visit to the Goon Squad.
Yeah.
And I also found that interesting in the sense of I could relate to it as a fiction writer, because every time you start another piece of fiction, that's what goes through your head. You know, I'm not sure if I can climb this mountain again, you know? And I mm-hmm. thought that was kind of a very meta moment early in the story that, you know, kind of, you know, wink, wink from Jennifer Egan, you know?
Well, and also along those lines at the very, very end of the book, the last chapter, which I've already talked about, but she makes these very explicit comments in the last chapter, in the very final paragraphs of the book, even, where she's essentially saying, like, the collective, which is what she has invented in this book, is basically what fiction writers are all about. You know,
right?
That's what fiction is for, is kind of creating this collective, you know, set of not memories, but like consciousness for everybody. And there were several lines at the very end of the book where I kind of wrote in the margin. I was like, well, she's basically talking to herself here.
Or yes.
Wait, it almost felt like, you know, justification for everything that preceded it, you know?
Like, yeah.
Yeah, there were definitely, and she's smart enough to kind of like add those moments in there and, you know, knowing that, you know, readers will pick up on that if they want to, but. You know, these novels are very impressive. They're kind of intellectual sort of puzzle boxes in a way, but there's a lot of satisfaction in that for a certain kind of reader. And certainly, like you said, if you're interested in some of these philosophical questions about what makes us human and the ways that technology tends to impact some of those thoughts and questions, you know, these books are probably for you. So.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Well, anyway, that was an interesting discussion. I hope we didn't lose everybody like 2 seconds into it, because it's a complicated journey we just went on. But I think we can say we highly recommend both books, and we recommend the work of Jennifer Egan if you want to read very provocative and intellectually engaging fiction. She's your lady.
Yep.
And so let's wrap it up there. Let's listen to some more music, and then we'll come back really quick. We'll talk about what we got next on the reading docket, and we'll tease episode 52.
Right on.
All right, here we go. John, what's next on your I'll tell you what. I'll do it first, because I'm going to ask you to tease episode 52 for us, if you don't mind.
Okay.
So next up for me, I have a lot of interesting books coming up, but every once in a while I do this, John, so I don't have to go on with it at length. I'm currently reading nonfiction. I'm, you know, doing some research for this burgeoning book that I'm trying to get off the ground, and that's fun and everything, but you know, every once in a while you just got to go back to the fountain. So I'm going to be and you know it's coming, but you know,
I know it's coming.
I gotta do it. I am going to read a book by one of my most beloved writers. That's Uncle Stevie, Stephen King. I usually am good for one or two books a year from Stephen King. I love his books, but I've never read, I'm excited. I've never read this book. Is one of his, you know, oldest and most famous books, that he has freely admitted he wrote completely loaded on coke, like he can't even remember writing it. So that should be interesting. And the book is called Cujo, from the '70s, about a rabid dog. And I honestly can't wait. It's going to be wild, and it's probably going to be pretty crappy in some ways, but it's going to be great fun. And you know, that's where I'm going. I'm going under that old log or whatever it is that the dog runs under at the beginning of the movie and gets, you know, bit by a rabid whatever, and, you know, turns into like a drooling killer. So I'm looking forward to that. What's coming up for you?
You gotta love it. You gotta love it. Going back to the Uncle Steve, well, you know,
I love it.
That's gonna be a lot of fun. Well, what's next for me isn't quite the same vibe, but it's, I realized, you know, I try to, as we've said many times, try to move in different directions with my reading. And I kind of realized it's been a while since I've read a good book of history. And right. I do like to read history, and this is sort of scratches that itch, but it kind of goes in other directions too. It's actually a book I bought for one of my sons when he graduated from high school. I don't think he's ready yet. Someday he probably will. But it was an ambitious pick on my part, you know, so something that I figured if he doesn't read immediately, he'll sort of grow into maybe. But I'm really curious about it too. And it's actually the first time I've read this particularly esteemed American historian named Doris Kearns Goodwin, who is maybe best known for a book she wrote called Team of Rivals that has to do with the Lincoln presidency and his cabinet. It was famously, supposedly a very influential book for President Barack Obama. But she also was she worked for many years with Lyndon Johnson and wrote a number of books on Lyndon Johnson. But she has a fascinating sounding book that's called Leadership in Turbulent Times. And it looks at the leadership styles of four different U.S. presidents and tries to extrapolate, you know, what it was that made them good leaders. So it's kind of, you know, it's a history book, but it also has to do with, you know, leadership in some way. And I just thought it sounded really interesting. So I've never read her before, never read this book before, but that's going to be my next read after I finish your book. So it's certainly going in a different direction, but I'm really looking forward to, I mean, she's a widely esteemed historian, certainly has spent the majority of her life, you know, studying American presidents and U.S. history. I think there's got to be some interesting stuff to be gleaned from reading a book like that from someone as accomplished as her. So I'm really looking forward to diving into that.
Well, that is a good one. That's very John F. Lovell. But I like history too, actually. I don't read it very much at all, but I like reading books like that. So I'm looking forward to hearing about it. That's, you know, she's a very esteemed historian, of course. So that's going to be cool. That's a good choice.
And a huge baseball fan, to bring it back around. She's written at least one book about being a baseball fan. So there you go.
Can't argue with that. So why don't you help us to tease what's coming up next, or episode 52?
Yeah. So just to wrap this up, here we appreciate everybody coming back to the show. As we said at the outset, took a little bit of a break, but it's good to be back, and we're going to keep going. The next episode 52, we're going to do something a little bit different. It's certainly different, because we're going to talk of, the entire episode is going to be about books that we haven't read, which is unusual for us. But what we wanted to do was we wanted to consciously do something a little bit different, and we decided we would look at the rest of the year, the calendar year for 2022. The year's about half over, so we're looking at the second half of the year. We're going to do a little research, and we're going to find out books that are forthcoming. So any kind of book that may be coming out the next calendar year, we might cheat a little bit, and, you know, if one of them gets pushed back to early 2023, whatever. But we're basically going to dedicate an entire episode to books that we're looking forward to for the rest of the year that are coming out, why we're looking forward to them. And it may give us a chance to explore some other writers that we've never talked about on the podcast before, or maybe never read before, but we've just, you know, heard about books that are coming that sound really interesting. So we're going to sort of chart a course forward for the rest of 2022 and kind of recommend
you know, prematurely recommend, I guess, books that are coming that our listeners may want to check out for one reason or another. But I know I started looking at, I was aware of a few books that are coming in the near future that I'm excited to read. So we can get into some of those. And then I started doing a little research and learned about some more books that are coming. Some of them are by authors that I follow for quite a while. Some of them are by authors that we've never read before. So I think it's just kind of be a big old mishmash, but it should be a lot of fun and something a little bit different for the podcast. So I hope you'll join us for that. That's episode 52.
Yeah, that's going to be cool. I kind of, you know, at first when you brought it up, I was like, well, you know, I mean, how do we talk for a while about books we haven't read? But on the other hand, you know, this is something that at least I do all the time. Just keep my eye on the, you know, the sources, whatever sources tell you about books that are coming out and, you know, just kind of build up excitement. And we talk, but I guess what I'm saying is it's part of this ongoing exchange that we've had for all this time. This is definitely a part of it. Like, we learn about books that are coming, we tell each other about it, and we like sort of riff on them. So this is very much a piece of that whole conversation. So it's going to be fun to do something that we have not done before.
Yeah, I think so. You're right. It's something that we've always done, you and I, with together, and that's the basis of the whole show. Kind of, you know, making public the conversation we've always had going on around books anyway. So it should be fun.
In fact, I think I did that last October. I think it was around October when they dropped into the media that the Candy House was going to be published in April. And I remember sending a link to an article to you saying that. And I was just kind of like, holy shit, you know, look at this.
Well,
you know,
there you go.
And then we riffed on it a little bit then. Yeah. So I remember how excited I was to hear that. So this is this is an extension of that. So that'll do it for episode 51. I hope we didn't kind of really mangle, Jennifer Egan's catalog. And I hope we had a discussion that's worthy to, you know, some of the great books that she has written. I hope people will go and check out her work if they haven't done so already. And we want to thank everybody for joining us around the world. And we'll catch you next time for episode 52.
Sounds good. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll be back soon.
Bye-bye now.